This is a production of Cornell University.
As we get this meeting started, we're going to first go ahead and call the roll, but I want to take a quick second and introduce our brand new clerk, Amanda Robinson, who will be taking over as clerk for the employee assembly and will be, you know, supporting us as best she can, so don't give her a hard time. Any words you want to say?
Yeah, thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Perfect. So with that, would the clerk please call the roll?
I apologize if I mispronounced names. Amani Allen.
Unexcused. Unexcused.
Matthew Carfella.
Excused.
Shelly Cowles.
Here.
Atu Darko.
Unexcused.
Liz Field.
She's here.
Just took a bite.
Kevin Fitch.
Here.
Tanya Grove.
Here.
Hazel Hall.
Excuse. She's on vacation.
Laura Johnson Kelly.
Here.
Jeremy Kruzik.
Unexcused.
Christy Wong. Christine Mahoney.
Here.
Linda Majani.
Here.
Robert Morris.
Here.
Brandy Nicholson.
Here.
Tamara Payne.
Here.
Carrie Sanzone.
She will be here. She's going to be on the call.
Yep. Perfect. And Tunde is now here.
Oh, Tunde just arrived.
Oh, okay. Tammy Shapiro.
Here.
Kathy Shields. BJ Siaf.
Here. Oh, there you go. Good work.
Ulysses Smith.
You'll never see me.
Michelle Stefanski Seymour.
Here.
Pilar Thompson.
Oh, excuse. Sorry.
Suzanne Wilcox.
An excuse.
That's all.
Cool. Perfect. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. Whew, math was not my major, but that was rough. Okay, great. So we clearly have quorum. So couple items. First, we're going to do a call for late additions to the agenda. Is there anything that is not currently on the agenda that somebody wishes to add as a late addition? Seeing none, that is closed. We're going to move forward with approval of the minutes. Imani Allen is now here. 19. Approval of the minutes. Both the minutes from... Give me the date. August.
Now I'm blanking.
20-something?
Yeah.
And our previous meeting. So both sets were put in the box, so everybody should have had access to them. Brian also sent out an email to all the members with a link to where those minutes were. So at this time, are there any motions for both sets of minutes? Correction. There's been a motion to approve both sets of minutes. Is there any dissent? Is there a second?
Second.
There's a second. Is there any dissent? Seeing none, both sets of minutes are approved. Moving on to committee reports. First is Elections Committee, fall election update, BJCS Soko.
So we're just moving the election calendar back 1 week to help out just with some logistical things. The student assembly elections were happening roughly at the same time as when our elections were, so just to help space things out and give the office a little bit more time to focus, we just moved them back. So now the new dates are... Let me make sure I correctly say these. Campaigning and, applications will be open, I think this week, right? Is that, they're setting stuff up there too. So they're open this week with a registration closing on September the 28th. I read that backwards. Applications are open on September the 20th. Registration for that will close on September the 28th. Campaigning will then begin on September the 29th and close on, if I bump this down one date, October the 5th, with voting happening on October the 6th and 7th. So, well, again, those will be all sent out. We're doing publicity. Again, the only three seats that we still have remaining are AAP, engineering, and hotel. So if you know folks in those colleges and schools, please encourage them to run for an open seat. So,
great.
Less than 3 minutes.
Okay. right on time. If I didn't even check. next is the President's Address to Staff Committee update, but also you.
So me again. So the President's Address to Staff, as you all know, October 11th, noon to 1. I'm looking for folks to help co-chair, and that doesn't necessarily mean like you're going to be doing everything, but it's mostly just working with me so that there's also someone besides me that knows how the President's Address works. It's a good learning opportunity for you. I don't want it to all reside in my head. I want there to be multiple people so that if anything happens to me, someone else knows what's going on besides just instructions I leave on a piece of paper. So that's one thing. And I'm also looking for leads to help do the audience mics and then just kind of help manage like food distribution, kind of check in the day of. So I'll put sign-up stuff in the box as well, too, but I just want to formally say that to everyone here so you hear that. If you're interested in kind of co-chairing it with me, email me, let me know. Phone call, carrier pigeon, whatever you want. Or if you're interested in the other things, let me know that as well, too. So, yay.
Perfect. So, again, if you're interested, let BJ know. And that is taking place October 11th. So, moving to report from the chair. So, a couple of things just to go through. We have a few big events coming up that are all assembly related. A couple of them are directed at the public. So, as BJ mentioned, October 11th is the President's Address to Staff. We're asking Hunter, or President Rawlings, to really take do this from a perspective of you've been here three times now. How has the dynamics between staff and the rest of the community changed over time? How has the community overall changed over time? Really taking a different approach as opposed to like what do you see happening in the future, the direction, because he's not really here to determine that for the long haul. Oh, look at us. Look at that. Am I in frame? No, I'm kidding. So that's that. Next, October 18th. If you recall, August 16th, we co-sponsored, along with HR, a staff forum that was focused on Black Lives Matter, Blue Lives Matter, All Lives Matter, what does it all mean, and to give staff an opportunity to come together, process all the events from the summer, try to have a dialogue to understand what each of the movements meant, and then talk about it in a sense, in a way that made sense for all of us. So because registration for that closed so quickly, within 4 hours, we were way over capacity, we've agreed to offer a second one. And so exec today voted in favor of co-sponsoring a second one. So we'll be doing that. The date for that is October 18th. And we will be sending out communications from Liz. We'll go out to the public to see that. But I would encourage you all to attend, encourage others to attend. If you are willing to volunteer, Christy last time did registration for us, which was wonderful and much needed. So if there are any folks who want to participate and volunteer in terms of the staffing or you want to facilitate one of the tables, do let us know, and then we can get you situated there. And then finally, our staff retreat is scheduled for October October 27th. 8 a.m. to 1 p.m. You should have received the calendar hold. A location is to be determined. Likely will be Africana or somewhere else. We'll see what works. But so if you haven't accepted that invitation, please do so. If you didn't receive it, please let us know because it's not a problem, and we'll go from there. Any questions on any of that or anything else going on? Fantastic. So again, those of you who are sitting on the wall, if you want to actually come to the table, we would love to have you. Don't try to hide from us. Just pull up seats. There's plenty of room. We can all speak together a bit more. There's some seats down there. There's a couple up here. So make it work. We want to keep it as collegial as possible. Okay. Next item on the – oh, look at that. Business of the day. We're there already. So business of the day today. First up, we have – for a discussion of the Fair Labor Standards Act decision and the impact on the staff community, Kim Babuka, Director of Compensation, is here to discuss that with us. Man, I just say and then walk through the door.
Good timing.
I know, perfect timing. So I'm gonna turn it over to Kim.
Kim, do you want to? We have a seat up here too. So. There's a seat up here. If you'd like to join us.
Oh, I'm sorry. So we just did a brief introduction. If you want to introduce yourself,
yeah,
and then
hop
right
oh,
into
yeah,
it.
Okay.
Oh, I didn't realize. I'm so sorry.
We're
good.
Okay, great. I'm Kim Babuka. I work in the Office of Human Resources in Compensation. I'm the Director of Compensation Services. And talk to you just a little brief update on the new overtime regulations of the Fair Labor Standards Act. So just as a few-minute update, we have in 2014, President Obama wanted to look at the Fair Labor Standards Act, so how much of a salary threshold you an employee needs to make to in order to be an exempt employee. And so currently it is $455 a week, which is that approximately $2,660 a year, $2,360 a year. New York State is higher. It's $675 a week. So we have been in New York State increasing that exempt salary threshold. So the final rule effective December 1st is that minimum weekly salary is increasing to $913 a week. So there has been a lot of hubbub, a lot of back and forth. You've probably seen a lot of information in the news. As a matter of fact, right now there's still information happening that potentially this will be overturned. So I think it's not really 100% sure until we hit December 1st. So just give a little bit of the what it means to be an exempt employee. So an exempt employee, you have to be meet three eligibility criteria. And so for exempt employee means you're not eligible for overtime. So you need to meet a salary basis test. That means you need to receive a fixed amount of compensation week after week after week. You need to meet a salary level test. So you have to meet the minimum salary level that we've dictated. So currently at $455, $675 in New York State. And you need to meet the job duties test. So even if you have those first two or even all, only one of them, you have to meet all three. So the job duties test is the role of the nature of the work that you're doing is independent discretion and judgment makes you exempt in nature. So your HR representatives have classified all of you staff into your current band classification. Some of you may be exempt, some of you may be non-exempt. So the final rule raises that eligibility to $913 a week, regardless of the amount of hours you work. So that's a little bit of change of what we have right now, regardless of the hours of, that you work. So even if you work part-time, that still means that you need to meet that salary threshold. So two options that we're having at Cornell is for those that do not have, do not meet that salary threshold, if they're close, their salary can be increased to remain exempt, or else the position will be changed to non-exempt and the person will be eligible for overtime. So communication has not come out officially across campus except for that that letter that went out to the PIs and on the academics. And so that was to get out a little bit of advance so that we could make sure that we, if they were considering a grant, that you need to make sure that they're aware of the new threshold. Exempt salary level does not apply to those in the teaching criteria, so like our lecturers and instructors and faculty. The teaching exemption does not have a threshold to it. It does apply to those, our banded exempt positions, band E through I, and librarians and academics, so it applies to those roles. Currently, graduate students are not considered employees, so when they are considered employees, if and when they are become considered employees, then we'll be looking at that again to see how this is all affected. So our timeline is currently our local human resources offices are reviewing the cases. We don't have many. And then the supervisors are going to work with local HR to implement the change. We've got some reference guides and some documents that we're going to be sharing with them for guidance. And we want to make sure that the change in pay is effective before the December 1st timeline. So right now, we're in the process of creating some training materials. We're in the process of developing some, you know, letters for communication and making sure the individual supervisors have a one-on-one discussion with
So with that, we're going to open the floor to questions.
You said that it has a possibility of being open.
Yeah.
What if we came from a founder with a $5,000 raise and a three-year quarter term? Are we expecting it?
I think it's highly doubtful that it will be overturned. I feel like I just needed to say, you know, that it's possible, but I think that they, I don't think it would really happen. So I think if that's the case, then, you know, we'll really decide. We'll really
exactly
decide.
We'll ask you
that. Yeah, exactly, exactly. Probably that's not. It probably won't happen.
Other questions?
I actually have one that's kind of, but we brought it up before, is K-bands from, it seems to be that it's different per division. How come we don't have just one K-band scale for everyone to use? We're seeing like a band F from HR versus another.
Mm-hmm.
You can see a big difference, like 5 to 10,000. I'm just curious.
So we have a performance-based market structure. So every job classification is based on market pricing. So we have a market sensitive pay range. So we have guidance around what the pay band should be, and it's kind of similar work within that same pay band, but every job classification is a little bit different. So we want to make sure that we provide the appropriate salary for every single job classification, because there's a difference in market between, you know, a library role versus an IT role versus an HR role versus a technical role, et cetera, et cetera. So we want to make sure that we're market sensitive as we compete within our peers. Mm-hmm.
Okay, quick question. So what's the estimated overall cost of this transition?
So many, many people are not, you know, many of the part-timers are just going to switching to non-exempt, right? So we're not increasing the dollar value. We don't really have a fair estimate yet, because what we're doing is we're providing the cases, individual cases, to HR. And so if there might be, if it's like a $1,000 or $2,000 change, maybe they'll change them, or you know, maybe they'll alter the duration of the appointment a little bit to say, you know, if you're, maybe we'll say, okay, we're going to be working 30 hours as opposed to 20 hours to be able to make that. So we're not quite sure what kind of avenue the employees are going to be taking, you know, the HR is going to be taking yet. So we'll probably have a better view when we get closer to the when we're closer to the fact.
Kind of in, from your perspective, what's the ultimate risk of job loss for a lot of people? Should the cost be a little too much for some folks? Some areas, particularly for some of the
Well, I think what they'll do is they'll, you know, change it to a non-exempt classification, right? So then they're paying, they'll be paying by the hour, so they won't have to just that increase. And that's exactly what, you know, maybe the nature of the law is really being able to say is, if you work more than your appointment duration, you should get paid for it if
right.
you make less than a dollar value. Yeah. So I think people have been, it has been pretty fair in our staff realm, as a matter of fact, our exempt band minimums are really already there. So, you know, we really don't have any staff other than maybe some part-timers that, that are necessarily low. So that's good news that we pay really well for our staff.
How do you anticipate this might affect, like, interns that are hired for the summer? Would they then be
So we typically recommend like a non-exempt, you know, putting in our interns and our temporary appointments, we would definitely recommend.
So I ask specifically, I work in residence life, so hourly doesn't work very well if you live at the time.
So some of the residence hall directors were working closely right there because the salary is low, and right now the housing does not include, it's not really necessarily in the threshold. Some of the roles could be considered maybe instructing. So I'm not sure. I think we'd have to look at that you know, that definition first of the actual role. So what we try to do first is make sure that we look at the nature of the role to find out if they're included or not included in the minimum threshold, and then take it from there to find out if we need to maybe increase hours, shorten duration, or, you know, change the nature of the work. So we're working closely with residence hall, but I haven't been talked about in interims or interns lately.
Yeah, I'm pretty much the only one in that office.
Oh,
from that.
That's probably why.
Well, maybe I'll get some follow up.
I would second that too. I mean, I was in one of those summer roles early on, and it's one of those jobs where you work a certain amount of hours, but legit, like, some things will come up, and so you have to address these student needs at odd hours of the time. And
sure.
Is that overtime? Is that, like, part of your salary work? It's a really gray zone for a lot of these student services positions.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, and I think that's exactly why we want to make sure that they meet that salary threshold, so that if there are that extra hours they need to put in, it's hopefully compliant. Yeah.
When you're talking about instructors being exempt, that includes lecturers and postdocs, that whole...
It doesn't include postdocs, it just includes lecturers and instructors and faculty.
Okay.
Postdocs need to be included in the threshold, meeting the threshold.
That will be an interesting conversation.
Yeah.
Final thoughts before we close off this portion and move on to our next item? Okay, so if other questions do come up, I encourage you to send them, and we'll try to compile them all in one place and then send them directly to you.
Great.
Would that be okay?
Great.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for
coming.
Thank you. We're going to keep you that long, but you're welcome to stay, have some lunch, and enjoy the conversation if you want
to. Thank you, though.
Thank you. Okay, so the next item on our agenda is the tobacco-free campus discussion. So there are quite a few faces around who have joined us for this discussion, and I'm happy to see that. It has come up in each of the assemblies, I think. Maybe not all of them just yet, but most of them at this point. So really, we just want to kind of have a round table discussion. I want to make it very clear that we are not here to introduce a new policy. We are not here to recommend a new policy right now. We are really just getting some information so everybody is on the same page with the basic set of understanding, and we can think about the feasibility of moving to a tobacco-free campus, but really understanding for the employee context what impact that would have on us. So I would encourage you to look at this through the lens of, you know, benefits, what other services might I need or my other employees need. Anything like that. Anything that comes to mind, I would focus on it. That way. Enforcement seems to come up a lot yesterday in the UA meeting. So think about it through that lens. But really, informal roundtable discussion. If you have a thought, just like raise your placard just a bit so I can see you, and then we'll get a speaker's list going. So if all of our guests could actually introduce themselves, because I know there's a lot of folks around here to be confusing. Ted, we'll start with you.
Okay. Thank you for inviting me. My name is Ted Sheely. I work for Thompson County Health Department and as coordinator of a program called Tobacco Free Thompson. You may recognize T-Free Zone logo around. I worked with the city when they put into place their, wrote and put into place their outdoor smoking law, which among other things banned smoking on the commons. I've been doing this part, the tobacco part of my job, for about 13 years, and we have part of the statewide tobacco control program that funds us, and there are people like me in every county across the state, so lots of experience all around.
I'm Bruce Roble, the administrative manager of the anthropology department, archaeology program, and I institute writing program. I've been at Cornell 36 years. I'm recently a recovered asthmatic, but my lungs aren't doing that great these days. So it's really of interest to me to see tobacco go away. I have my master's from Cornell. My undergrad was at SUNY Cortland. And I say that because SUNY Cortland in July of 2011 proposed a tobacco-free campus, and it was instituted January 2013. So if my undergraduate college can be tobacco-free, certainly Cornell can be tobacco-free. Now, way back when, Cornell was the first Ivy League for ROTC. Cornell could also be the first Ivy League for tobacco-free. What I'm really interested in is if I'm walking on the sidewalk or any kind of common path and I'm following someone who's smoking, I can only hold my breath for so long. So, you know, anywhere where you can expect another person to be, if you can go smoke on that tree at 300
And we're going to credit Bruce for actually raising this issue a few years ago.
Yeah.
So Bruce worked on it a few years ago, and then Christine has some folks in her area bring it up again. So I just want to give credit where credit's due to all the folks who actually brought this to the assembly. So thank you for that. And also, I just want to mention before we continue, you all received all the documents were put in box, so you got them before the meeting. You didn't have to print them, but you want to make sure everybody knew that they were there and accessible. So if you have your laptop available, you can look at them in box as we go along. Go ahead.
My name is Sarah Hayes. I'm the manager of capital projects for the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences. I'm also the university college rep for the ag class innovation. If you guys want to, so typically all the buildings on the ag quad are 25 feet off the building for no smoking. When we started the ag quad construction project, most of the smoking areas inside the quad were removed because of the construction, so people started moving into different areas behind Mann Library. So 2 months ago, we started getting complaints from different groups that the smoking zones had moved. Even though they're outside 25 feet of the building, they're in major common walk thoroughfares. So I reached out to Christy because I saw she had smoke-free zones around the MVR quad, and we instilled the same situation behind Mann Library going from Emerson down through the Dean's Garden. We put up smoke-free zone signs. We just kind of rolled it out. We didn't put anything out in emails or any announcements or anything. I didn't want to completely alienate smokers without taking time to figure out what our issues are to relocate. So there's a plateau up behind the Dean's Garden, and it's fully wooded. So we put all the dispensaries up there so they had a shady space to go to within 200 feet of Warren Hall. So that at least they had a facility. I know the Vet College has instigated a complete smoke-free zone, but they did create smoking environments within their building. So Hales was just starting to figure out what other colleges are doing, what our options are, obviously without upsetting or being aware of the different employees.
When she says shady, she means like actually shaded, not sketchy shady. They have a shady spot to be in.
I didn't want people in parking lots.
I'm just kidding. I was like, I'm missing somebody.
I'm Ruth Rowe Doyle. I'm here in Bethany Kennedy's place. I work for Cornell Wellness, and my job was the point person for tobacco cessation. So I'm the person who, if anyone wants to quit, whether it be an employee or a spouse or a partner or a dependent, it is free for them to have individual consultation. Or there are times when departments or groups of people will come together to have more of a group tobacco cessation programming event.
Next on the line, Allie.
Hi, everybody. My name is Allie. I'm a Western undergraduate student in the College of Kinesiology.
Choking on that free lunch. I'm kidding.
No, I think I'm touching something.
I was like, thanks.
I'm an undergraduate student in the College of Kinesiology. I've been working on this initiative.
Charlie, did you want to introduce yourself also, by the way?
I'm Charlie Gamal. I'm the faculty. I'm just here to listen and find out what you guys think.
So be true to form.
Hi, everyone. I'm Sharon Goodman. I work at Gannett Health Services. Thank you for your patience with our messy project out in the plaza. But we're really excited about the addition we have. We've had to clarify the 25-foot smoking from building in our new arrangement. We have been involved with efforts over decades, and I think our
gone all smoke-free, but the SUNY Board of Regents has voted to recommend that, but it has to be a legislative.
Okay.
Has to be passed by the legislature, but all dorms, so something the legislature did pass on that was prior to that, they made all dormitories.
I will just mention that we provide support for students who are trying to quit smoking, and of course our pharmacy has products for people who are trying to quit smoking. We have information on our website. What we have to do is people who are vaping.
I'm upset that I got that.
The good news is that the actual rates of smoking are quite low, except for those occasional smokers who don't consider themselves smokers. They only smoke at parties.
So as we go through this discussion, right before I promise, keep interrupting everybody. As we go through this, I would encourage you to please speak in voce alto, loudly, so Carrie can hear it also who's joining us, but also for recording purposes because this is public, so we just need to make sure that everything's picked up. So project, come on, all of that, intonation, inflection, yes. Okay, Christine.
Hi, I'm Christine Spahn. I'm the Associate Vice President of Environmental Health and Safety. Thanks for inviting me. I'm excited to see this conversation start. If you've noticed, if you had the opportunity to read the new, the policy's been updated to include electronic cigarettes, vaping, and we are now in line of where you can't smoke, you cannot vape. So we've had a lot of questions come to our office. We've answered and called back, but I know for a while there when vaping first came and there wasn't a lot of regulatory body work around that, we were handling a lot of one-offs and just slightly asking people in the areas. So we're well aware. We've also heard from some professors on campus that are looking at vaping in a different light, which is, you know, to help remediate the tobacco smoking. So we had some interesting discussions as we change the policy. I learned a lot of items. Our office does a lot of regulatory work, so it sits in my office today. I think as this conversation expands, I'm sure that discussion should expand along with it, and so I'm happy to be part of your roundtable.
Fantastic. I didn't miss anybody, did I? Perfect. So I know you have to leave a little early, slightly early. Since the policy lives with you, I just want to make sure that everyone knows that Christine is here really to really offer that perspective. So as much in the way that you have questions around the policy, get them in kind of early so that she's able to answer them about that. But to start this off, I would like to know from your perspective, what are some of the other remediations or stuff that have been discussed with the faculty and others? Because that's an interesting note to me.
I think there's some research that's happening, you know, across the country, and Sharon may know more information that is looking at vaping as a replacement for smoking in a tobacco-free, nicotine-free, and or getting people off of that, you know, substance to the other, and then working their way down. I don't want to act like I'm not knowledgeable enough. As I was presenting why we should not allow vaping on campus in the same areas we don't allow smoking, I really was not aware of that research, and there is research out there. So if people are interested, they should probably look and see what that is. I don't believe the research is probably
but I think it's a long way. I mean, they've been studying burning tobacco for a long time. A large part of it, I think, there are definitely camps on the e-cigarettes. There's the harm reduction camp, and there's the addiction is addiction, and no matter what you do, how you get it in there, it's a nicotine delivery device. And then there's sort of a side camp of that, which is something that we pay close attention to in my program, which is youth initiation. The e-cigarettes are really turning around the whole youth use of nicotine dramatically. And so e-cigarette use among teenagers has skyrocketed, and that's a gateway to being addicted to nicotine, and it's a very difficult addiction to deal with.
Being a former smoker myself, I have definitely been on board with it. It was a terrible thing to get away from for many years. I'm really glad to see this come up. And my question is, specifically, is there any real belief that Cornell could become a leader in Ivy League to create an actual smoke-free campus? That something that is viable in the foreseeable future?
Alex had I think he can tell you.
We could enact it tomorrow.
Christine panicked just a little bit when you said
I believe that with the assemblies on campus and the discussion starting here, I think the time has changed from the original report that Beth has produced, I think in 2009, and I reread the report just to refresh myself. I was pretty new then, so I don't even think I knew I owned a smoking policy probably at that point, just in fairness. And it's interesting now because I think there's been changes since the 2009 report already, whether they're regulatory changes and whatnot. And I think, as Sharon said, there's some decreasing seeing on campus of smoking as your surveys are finding. So I think the discussion's right. And I think people are open to hear the discussion. And, I'm excited truly to see the discussion start. I think there's many people either in this room or have relatives that have similar situations. And we do know that people are affected as a secondhand, and that's our complaint areas, right? It's not always that it's in front of the building. It's what you were describing, or they could smell that they've been.
You can't walk into the libraries without going through a conference.
And we've discussed with the libraries, and we've come up with solutions. Christy's been a really strong advocate of working with the other colleges as well to push that 25 foot out. And it is successful in the areas that it's been working in, and I'm glad that people are still looking at this. So I'm interested to see what all the assemblies say so we can have this forum moving.
But if the only entryway into a building is 50 feet out, you have to go through that.
And I think that's an issue that's been brought up. Sometimes, especially during construction, people tend to push, and there's only so many walkways to take.
Mm-hmm.
And we found in some instances, even when this building was being constructed, that a lot of people choose to stand off of the sidewalk, and they're not in the grass, or they're not in an area that's not in your general walkway, especially as you go up the hill, which we've worked with that.
Even right outside of the Cornell Police Division in Barton Hall, they smoke right next to the sidewalk, where if you walk up to go to Siegel, you walk right through it.
That's probably now our largest complaint that we've received.
Hmm. Amani, did you have a thought earlier, or did I?
I think what I was understanding was the chairman was going to
facility of staff of Pacific and Adriel in that break. So if there are opportunities to provide alternative spaces, but also what does that mean for them, you know, in terms of they have 15 minute break, how far you have to go to smoke, you know, cigarette. And I'm not necessarily condoning smoking because I'm a former smoker, but I also know that's a very hard habit to quit. And so in terms of let's go smoke free, you know, next year or whatever, kind of what does that mean for those staff members to do smoke? And so is it, you know, just go smoke free, or is there to be kind of, you know, a phase? And in that phase, provide them more information about the different resources that is on campus in terms of what's free, you know, and what is free and maybe a little longer term.
Yeah. Did you answer to that, Ted?
So just a couple of things. Just I will speak to that. I would like to just go back to the pushing it away from buildings. You know, when the city first made the common smoke free, they only made the inner part of the common smoke free, what was called the inner T. And then they found that what happened was everybody smoked right on the line. There was actually a line on the sidewalk that said, this is where you can't smoke from here on in. Everybody stood right on the line and smoked. And so then they pushed it back to the entire common, and everybody stood on the end of the common and smoked. So then they made, you know, three blocks at the west end of the common smoke-free. So it is, and as Bruce was saying, people do go in, and I, you know, my view of this, and I smoked for 20 years. I do not have a chronic disease that is affected by it, but I still see it as really not that much different than curb cuts. I mean, you can't, you know, nobody expects somebody who's using a wheelchair to have to go and find a way to get up on the sidewalk or find a way to get in the building. And really, for somebody who has asthma or somebody who's been treated for cancer and therefore has a lower immune system, has issues or all kinds of other issues, it's really the same kind of thing. I mean, that's the way I have come over the years to view it. It's really, it's something that should have been ideally in the ADA as another access thing. As far as phasing it in, when Bruce mentioned the SUNY Cortland example, that was a year and a half that they took in order to really build it up. And they still, at this point, have a monthly meeting of a tobacco advisory board, a tobacco task force, where they still are troubleshooting problem areas on the campus where people are hanging out and smoking, or concerns that people have gotten about cessation issues or something like that. So it is a totally ongoing thing. It's something that it's vital that it is well constructed. Although, you know, the policy, the Cortland policy, is short and pretty much to the point. But then it's got to have a long, or, you know, reasonable at least education period. You have to give people who do smoke, you know, a time, a chance to really figure out, okay, how am I going to deal with this now? What am I going to do? And so as a friend of mine who's a cessation specialist says, you know, how am I going to get through the day? And people have to plan that. And that's part of, I mean, it's really, you have to look at this always as, you know, you have to maintain respect for the people who use tobacco. Because reality is most of them, at least surveys, you know, show that most people who use tobacco, in particular people who smoke, would quit tomorrow if they could. But they just can't. I mean, the addiction aspect of it and the behavioral aspect of it is majorly fierce. And so you have to recognize that the Surgeon General calls it smoking a pediatric epidemic. The New York State Department of Health calls it a chronic disease, and so it's really an addiction. You know, considers it an addiction. So it's really something you have to look at it like that, and you have to build in those transition periods accordingly.
BJ, then Linda.
I had a separate question, so I don't know if yours was related to what's going on.
I think I'll just go five of them.
you want to speak to that?
I'll just say the upside of not being out in front on this issue is that there are dozens and dozens and dozens across the country that have already done this. And I'm sure they have had some of these questions over. And so I bet you we're going to find a lot of resources out there that can help us think through what are the options. And I bet you we'll find campuses that have different kinds of options. Some can say, we're going to put all our resources into smoking cessation programs. We're going to put some resources into smoking hubs. I just think we'll see a lot of things out there. We don't need to answer that question to get started, because there are, did you share the link to the tobacco-free campuses?
Yeah.
Just go there. You'll see, I don't know how many schools there are in New York State already, but it's 30 in New York State. There are listed there.
So I'm proud of our country of always making progress and moving to the generation where smoking is eliminated out of the country. But you have to remember that our American population of college-bound population is shrinking, and we have a ballooning college-bound population from other countries that are coming in. And their culture is that smoking is maybe acceptable. So that's going to have to be addressed as well.
Very good point. Tanya, did you want to speak to that?
So I think what I had the same thing as what Linda and Liz were saying, but just to respond, Sharon, I think for us in the country, if we start down and say this is the goal for Cornell, we're going to get asked that question. Where are we going to get sent, or are we looking at what are we looking for? So I think it's really important for us to be able to be prepared to have some, don't panic, because we're thinking about you as a smoker and that you may not want to quit. Some people may not. I mean, I did, and I'm happy to hear so many other people did. The other question that I had was for, probably some more for me, but where do people deposit and how fit into campus?
Well, the state, there's state regulations, so they pretty much still apply. Now, the 25-foot rule, you can search that, unless I'm wrong, and you're not going to find that. So that's, so we've invoked that. So the
county has a law that says you can't use vaping indoors.
Right. So we have you can't smoke in there and you can't vape in there, which I think everybody realizes that. I think your next question is, so it's okay if you're right outside the door, where we say it's got to be 25 feet.
Because you can see it at the house.
Yeah, boy. So, I've actually gone out and told people that you're not going to smoke up here. So I heard Kevin probably seen me. I'm not shy on that. But I'm also in agreement with you. What people are saying is you have to have some environment so people can, that don't want to stop, have a place to go. And then we have all the education and sharing. I really appreciate the comment that there's a lot of other places we could start to look to see. And unfortunately, my role is regulatory, so I can do the regulations. I'm glad I got the 25 feet in. And I think someone else probably pushed that before I came, but I'm happy to try to keep that as Cornell EHS policy. And then the discussion is bigger.
Did you want to respond?
Well, I think that what you were saying, also we need to think the definition of what the smoke-free campus is, and our facility, how they're part of campus, the Seneca Place are part of campus, are all the greenhouses and various areas part of campus.
Geneva.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a question to
go on.
My boss. Because part of the policy is one of the things I didn't know what was, I don't smoke. So I read the policy for the first time. And what I was actually curious is entrances to any university owned or controlled building. One of the questions I had was, what is a controlled building?
That's good. So I think I can answer. There are buildings that we own, and then there are buildings that people use as
building, we don't control the building. That would be an uncontrolled use. A residence that houses students for Cornell but is not owned by Cornell is not a building I have under the control of this policy. So it's a good question. I don't want you to think that student life, they're also addressing it. If you read the policy, you'll see there's an exemption, and that's because some of those locations. So the one thing I do want you to know is this is for a while as well.
Mm-hmm.
So and we're going to work with New York Tech as well.
Mm-hmm.
So while and our campus are trying to, so when you have the same experience, right, and I just want to make sure you're also aware, so as we look at maybe perhaps changing a policy, you know, I don't think there's going to be any issue for a while on any of the items that are discussed here. Just, you know.
And I think that's where you were going with it. So like PNC, I mean, Cornell owns that. They rent, so
that's yeah, we've actually had, go ahead.
So I was just thinking the notion of, you know, if that's not a Cornell owner controlled building, people can stand anywhere.
Yeah, I think it will be interesting. I'm assuming it's taken, so since you were taken, there was no getting taken. I think that's got to go in that bucket of questions, because I honestly, I don't think I can give you a good answer.
I know Alex had a question, and then I'll get back to Ted. Are you good?
Yeah.
Oh, good.
And one off thing is also the enforcement of this.
That was my question.
Oh.
I think that Alex talked that long and hard. I think when that was becoming smoke-free.
So,
please go for
okay.
it.
So, just a couple of things I'll just throw out. Based on best practices, there was a guy who came around. He's actually from a small technical college in South Central Missouri. His name is Ty Patterson, and he became the national guru on tobacco-free colleges. And he learned a lot and set out some pretty very straightforward guidelines. And among them was that you really, the simpler the policy, the better. And so the absolutely most simple policy would be there is no smoking on Cornell property, owned whatever, however you want to do that. Because then everybody knows that. And you're not saying, well, I couldn't find the designated smoking area here, so I'm just smoking here. And because now I'm over on this area of campus, and I don't really know, it's like me trying to find a parking place here. I don't really know where if this lot is full. Now where do I go? Well, I don't know where the designated area is over on this side, so I'm just going to stand here and smoke. And people do that. I mean, they're not mean or trying to be defiant. They just, if they know that there's a designated smoking area, then they know that smoking is okay someplace. So, again, I'm just throw that out, that for simplicity's sake and for enforcement's sake, that's the gold standard. And then from the enforcement side, you know, something I think that is important to think about is that nobody's going to, I mean, typically, I don't know how you want to do it here, but typically, unlike the city of Ithaca, where they do write tickets for people who are smoking in areas that are designated smoke-free, there are no tickets written in this. This is something, the way this, again, best practice, is that this sort of thing is basically peer enforced, is that everybody has equal responsibility to establish the norm and be in compliance. Now, obviously, there are other issues, and I think within the Cortland policy that I've sent to Ulysses, it does say that disciplinary action will be like it is with any issue with employment. But for the most part, what the long-term goal for something like this is, in my mind, is that in 10 years, this will be an established norm, and this will be the culture of Cornell University. It's not going to happen in 1 year. It will happen in 4 years with undergrads because they will turn over every 4 years. But you know, from a long-term standpoint, it's not going to be the first day it goes into effect, even if you've got had a year to plan for it. It's not going to be perfect. It's not going to be perfect in 6 months. It's going to change with the season. But you're working towards a new social norm and a new culture which establishes. And so that's another sort of a long-term view of this kind of thing.
FYI, we have about 5 minutes left in this discussion, so we still have time to get to our standing rules today. Did I just miss the mic? BJ, sorry.
So that was, I think, your segue into what my question was. And I think establishing of social norms and enforcement of this, if it's peer-to-peer, is my biggest, not obstacle, but I think that's what is often unaddressed when we create new policy. It's like, that's great that we've created this, but then how does it come into being? And I hope that's something that they definitely consider, because when I hear the words peer-to-peer, I think that's where a lot of this confrontation lies, where some of us are totally fine saying, hey, you can't smoke here, like, move somewhere else, versus other folks that might not be there. And that really creates this tension between staff members and peers, and sometimes even between staff members and students, or however that looks. So I just hope there's some way to also address that once a policy is created in that sense as well, too.
So like Portland State University created a video that does role-playing that shows you sort of how to approach somebody. And,
yeah.
Sort of, again, the, you know, the best practice through Ty Patterson is you say, maybe you didn't know what the policy is the next time you're here. So you're not telling somebody to put that out. You're saying the next time you're here, now you know the policy. So again, as was said, this is being done all over the place. Binghamton University is working on it. Syracuse University, I mean, some of these places like SU, they're downtown. So it's a different kind of situation where you have this vast property here. Binghamton is a little bit more contained. I have no idea what Yale is like. But it's still, there are plenty of examples. So.
We're on concerns about what Yale is like. They can figure it out for themselves. No, but it does. Yeah, Kimmy?
And you have great people who, you know, at Gannett, I mean, who understand this messaging, or at least are working hard on this messaging, and Ruth and Beth, you know, I'm sure also, you know, but yes, absolutely, that you have to, I mean, it's really valuable to look at it from that standpoint. That's the way, you know, as things are moving along, that's the way health departments, the state health department, the CDC, all these places, that's how they're looking at this. It is an addiction, treat it like an addiction, and you have to, and you know, and norms and approaches how you deal with that, with addictions are evolving, and for, you know, in a way which is much more successful, I think.
It's an interesting question of enforcement, and it goes back to exactly what you said, Imani, a little earlier about, you know, if someone is on their break for 15 minutes and they're an employee, you know, even if you have a smoking hut somewhere, how much time must this person dedicate to getting there? Can they use their break in the way they want to? But it's also, I think I mentioned this last night at the UA meeting, it's for a lot of people, philosophically, this is going to be a difficult thing. I'll get you, don't worry. It'll be a very difficult thing to tackle, just because there are a lot of people who are philosophically going to disagree with the institution and institutions going that deep into their personal life for something that in their minds might be very, very small or a very minute thing, especially when they don't live here. You know, it's one thing if you live in Thompson County, you live in Ithaca, but if you live, you know, we have many employees who live in Pennsylvania who commute. I don't know Pennsylvania law, so I don't, you know, don't. Yeah. I was like, I imagine it's not the same. But, you know, to do that, and then what resources am I getting at home versus what's being offered here? So there's a lot that I think we have to question. Did you want to speak to that, Bruce?
Yes. Even if we can't go tobacco-free, I would have an analogy of you can't drive and text at the same time. Mm-hmm. You have to pull off and text if you're going to do that. I would think if you're smoking on campus, you can't walk on the sidewalk and smoke. You need to pull off somewhere. So
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
get off of the common pathways and be somewhere out of the way. That would be a good compromise.
One just very quick last thing that I was thinking about too is that, as you were speaking, Ulysses, was that, you know, there is a whole other side to this, and that is the financial side.
Exactly.
Is that there? You can look. I mean, you can Google, and you'll find very quickly. I don't know what the numbers are right off, but they're in the range of $3,000 to $5,000 per employee of additional cost in healthcare. And so, really, you know, if you want to look at it from that standpoint, there is a very clear cost factor where people who don't smoke or smoke less, and if this campus is tobacco free, the people who do smoke will smoke less. Costs have much lower costs, both in productivity and just outright healthcare costs.
Absolutely, something to absolutely consider. And I know you mentioned a little earlier, Sharon, that there was. I know your report, but you said that there was some data available, but I know Alex talked about this last night. We haven't actually analyzed people's behavior. We're not capturing that anywhere. So do we really have a good estimate of how many smokers are here, whether they're occasional, social, or actual lifelong smokers?
We have some data about students.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The adult rate for Tompkins County is 14%. The adult rate for the Southern Tier is closer to 20%. So for adults. So, you know, since you draw from, we are, as we are in so many things, we are an oasis in the middle of 14% in the middle of basically. I mean, Cayuga County I think is 24%. So for adults. So it's. But we did actually a class at Ithaca College did a survey, and they got 700 employees responded to the survey, and it was all employees, staff and faculty, I believe, and that smoking rate was below 10%, according to that survey. So it's really hard to know.
Oasis for only about 4 months out of the year. Let's hold the rest of the year.
Okay, Florida.
We are, and we, oh, not we.
I don't know if there's room
for the other questions. Well, that deadline was early September. We actually had Marin Parker come in, and we talked about that. And had I known this was a topic of interest, we certainly could have included a question on there. So maybe the alternative now would be, instead of doing it on the employee survey, to actually put it on the occasional climate surveys that happen or that are sponsored by individual units and departments. To get that on there, we just have to make sure it's a consistent question, but we won't be able to fit it on the employee survey for this go-round, but next 5 years, let's get it on there. So just want to recap before we close this off. So there are a lot of things that we've talked about today, so philosophical piece of this, kind of the long-term health costs and benefits, however you want to look at it, implementation, is it going to be phased or not, really collecting data, I think, is going to be an important piece, including data on citations and on ticketing and enforcement, the accessibility perspective, which I think is actually a really interesting perspective to take this from, and the culture change. There are a lot of things you have to consider. So if you're interested in continuing to engage in this conversation, which I really think you all should, we'll continue to talk about it as an assembly, but last night at the UA, they formally referred the matter to the Campus Welfare Committee, which will be kind of heading up that effort to really look at it from a cross-constituent perspective. That way, so that committee has students, faculty, staff on it, both undergraduate and graduate. So we'll be talking about it from there. We will be inviting, of course, all of the guests who are here today to continue, because we want to engage in this conversation going forward. The unfortunate part if you want to do that is that I chair that committee. So if you want to deal with me twice, good luck. But I would encourage you, if you're interested in really continuing that or working on that very diligently, then please do email me and we can get you on the list so that you're kept in the loop about what's going on. Any other questions before we move on? Great. So if not, thank you so much to all of our guests for being here. You're welcome to stay as we talk about standing rules, but I don't know if you want to take some food, whatever it is. But thanks so much for doing this and for taking time out of your day to be here for us. Alright, so in the remaining minutes that we have, these are in the box. So there are a couple versions, so it might be a little confusing. I apologize for that. Yeah, I meant for the version that actually has the comments that you have here to be the one that is the most up-to-date one, and it's put in the format with the line number so that it makes the most sense. So basically what you see, this is on behalf of, I'm just going to announce this on behalf of Hazel, who is not here right now. She's happily out on vacation like the rest of us. this is what we're proposing. So these are adapted from some of the other assembly rules. They're generally pretty standard. They're not completely like over the top. We're going to police you, do all these things. The only, I think, things that are kind of most salient would just be kind of attendance is the thing. That's going to be a thing, and we're going to have to talk about that regardless is one area. So that's somewhere, it's like line 60-something. Line 69, kind of rule 4 talks about that. The rest of them really are just kind of discussing, codifying what we've been doing all along in terms of how we govern a meeting with a speaker's list, all that other type of good stuff, how the agenda is set. So, and we left all the comments on there so people saw the questions that we had and general stuff like that. So if you have comments, questions, Gina, you have some things. So, yeah. Yeah?
I can go after. On line 14,
mm-hmm. No.
Not sure.
No, I would. I don't know. We're redefining who we are as an assembly. Yes. So, BJ, would you mind making a motion? Because I actually can't make a motion.
Yeah. So, make a motion. We want to strike staff.
Just strike and staff and.
Yeah. Here. So let me read this. So on line 13, these standing rules shall be adhered to by all employee assembly members and committee members. Striking and staff from 14 and adding the word and
before
committee on line 13. That's the motion.
Is there a second? Been seconded. Is there any dissent to that?
I'm wondering about that because I think it makes it hard to deal with staff. That's how I read that. That means
that could be another one.
So I'll remove my motion and
withdraw
and change that to these standing rules and et cetera shall be adhered to by all employee assembly members, committee members, and
ex officio
members.
So the motion is made and has been seconded for Amanda Fuck. What in the world are these people doing? It has been seconded. Is there any dissent? Seeing none, may I ask that we vote by unanimous consent to approve the amendment? All in favor of unanimous consent? I mean,
yeah.
You don't have to agree. like any dissent to unanimous consent. Great. It's approved. So, all right. Other areas or questions that needed to be answered? Michelle.
69, highlighted in purple.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're all adults here. We do try to arrive on time, but thanks to our busing and so on. For other meetings that may be late, we may be coming in or have to have a closing thing, so I would like to strike that out. But I would say people who came in late after roll call, it is their responsibility to make sure that they are found.
Absolutely. And I'm glad you, thank you for making that motion. On behalf, that's me in the purple. I was like, no, we don't need that. So there's a motion on the floor to strike line 69 through 71, the phrase or the statement, any late arrival or early departure from a required meeting will result in a half absence. The executive committee reserves the right to decide what constitutes a late arrival or early departure.
So seconded.
by Representative Pitch. Seconded. Is there any dissent to the amendment? Seeing all in favor of the, or actually you don't have to raise your placard. Can we move this by unanimous consent? Any dissent to unanimous consent?
Is that part of our rules?
Yeah, yes, we can vote for Robert's rules by unanimous consent. Seeing no dissent to that, then the amendment is adopted by unanimous consent. Other items? There's a question, yes.
Real quick to excuse F.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see anything about vacation being away from. Is it in there?
87? So anything that would constitute grounds for excuse from work-related obligations, that counts. So vacation time, because you put that into work day or what, we're all using work day, right? Exactly. So if it's a day that you block off, that it's all you. You're good. Other questions? Tammy.
I would say in response to that, I think that's like a work. I think that falls under work thing. Yeah.
And we wouldn't.
I would. I was like, yo, do your job.
This is volunteer.
Yeah.
The it's paid. Sonia, you had a question also?
That was my question.
Okay. So, I think.
Oh, and one other. What are the allowed number of absences?
Good. Good question. What is the allowed number of absences? 94. Vote. 94. So that's a good question. What seems reasonable?
Versus someone who is just falling off the radar.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if you have a number in there or there's some other mechanism to bring that back to conversation.
Yeah, we don't have a number. Go ahead.
My suggestion is that we're looking at a minimum. So when we think about this, we're going to think, what is the fair minimum that somebody should be in this? And there is something to set for being here in this. Even if you are outside participating because you can't get some of this content outside of this room. So looking at that, my suggestion is that we just refer to the majority of the available meetings. So more than half.
So Liz and then Laura.
Number of excused or unexcused absences. I mean, what are we talking about here? So are we going to have an allowed number of excused and an allowed number of unexcused?
Could be a question.
So I wanted to ask too. I've been a member of some organizations where if you had three consecutive unexcused absences, somebody just decides not to go.
Hmm.
Can I make a motion? I'll make a motion then to in line 95 in the highlighted section in blue, changing that to such as members in jeopardy of exceeding three unexcused absences to the chair. I think that's a good, I like that idea. It's like three things that are unexcused. It's just, hey, what's going on?
Well, there's a motion on the floor.
A little bit about what excuse and what not.
Exactly. So noting that we have expired the time, any final thoughts?
Real quick, added to that, what I think we should consider is adding something in here to the effect of, it's not a negative against the person with it, but
right.
We need somebody in here that if you can't make these, we should have somebody else doing that.
Right.
That we should think about make the majority of the meeting unless in some extreme situation that's decided by the executive board. So an out for that edge case scenario.
Perfect. So we'll do that. We'll consider that an exec again one more time and then bring that back to the body. It will be the first item on our agenda. We will pass some rules. Great. With that, is there a motion to adjourn?
Make a motion to adjourn.
Yes, motion to adjourn. It's been seconded. Have a great day. Thanks so much. Any other questions that come up, please do let us know.
This has been a production of Cornell University. On the web at cornell.edu.